I think that with digital media and social media, customers have just become so much more sophisticated and well-educated on certain subjects, especially this. And so I think it's just making the consumer more demanding and more sophisticated, and they're making more demands on the brands that they choose to buy.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So today we are in for a treat because we're talking to somebody who has been in the independent beauty world for quite a while, Sarah Kugelman. She has been the founder and CEO of Skin Iceland for almost 15 years. And I really wanted to talk to somebody who's been around and seen a number of different trends within the beauty landscape, just because, first off, for those of you who don't know, I have a long career in beauty. And I think it's something that really speaks to all of us. You know, at the end of the day, the things that we ingest, the things that we put on our skin, they really matter to us. And those are things that, you know, we'd like to talk about AI and virtual reality, but a lot of us are really down to earth and think about things that are tactical and tangible, right? So Sarah has seen a lot and has a lot of really compelling views about the future of the beauty industry. And that's really why I wanted to have her here today. So without further ado, welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
So first thing that I like to ask a lot of people is, who the heck are you? What do you do? And for you, since I know a little bit about this, but I'd like to ask you even like your origin story, kind of how, what started you on this path of creating a really compelling independent beauty brand that's managed to stay on the market for so long?
Well, I think I've always been a beauty junkie since the beginning. Even as far back as I can remember, I've always loved makeup and skincare. And, you know, I grew up in a super smart, intellectual family, and I feel like I was always made fun of because I read beauty magazines and fashion magazines and bought beauty products and spent a lot of time doing that. And so who knew it would actually work in my favor someday? But pretty much out of school, I started in beauty, and I just, you know, have been in it ever since. I started in marketing and product development. I went to business school, actually got an MBA. So I turned out not to be that dumb after all, but put my MBA to good use in beauty. And I started on the corporate side of the business, working in, you know, big companies and sort of learning the ropes, and then went off on my own in 1999, started my first company, which was called gloss.com, which was the first beauty internet site.
Which is just also, I'll just say a funny thing, in that this was this thing that I knew about years ago, and little did I know I would wind up working with and knowing this person who had, you know, it's kind of interesting. You just, the world becomes smaller, you know, the longer you're around.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, my daughter who's 12, I told her recently, you know, mommy started the first beauty internet site. And that's just incomprehensible for a 12-year-old. She said, what do you mean the first beauty internet site? First beauty internet site. She said, how come you're not more famous? So, you know, this is how it goes. I said, well,
if it makes you feel any better, I mean, I told my daughter that I knew a time before Netflix, and she said, how did you even live? And she's six, so.
Exactly. They're very sophisticated. So after I sold Gloss to Estee Lauder, I worked at Estee Lauder for a couple of years doing a variety of things, including working in a think tank. But I really had the bug to be an entrepreneur for the second time around 2003. And I left Estee Lauder at that time and kind of threw myself into the world of wellness, which was something that I had a real personal passion for. I certainly had a lot of experience dealing with stress, working in the corporate world for many years, you know, sitting on airplanes for, you know, week after week, not sleeping, eating all the wrong things. And, you know, it definitely took its toll on my health and therefore on my skin as well. And I really became very in tune with that inner and outer connection and everything going on the inside, showing itself on the outside. You know, our skin is really a window into our inner health. And so I left Estee Lauder to study the whole connection between stress and skin for a year and a half. And I work with a team of doctors and experts and sort of found out there were five symptoms of stressed skin. And that's what got me interested in starting a line to address those five symptoms.
So as we're talking about the very happy thing of skin stress and just not looking your best, I want to switch topics to ask you some irreverent questions, get to know you before we really jump into the meat of the interview.
Okay. Sure.
Okay, one question is, I know you've had to travel a bunch for work. Are there any particular cities or places that really speak to you as a person?
Well, Iceland, obviously. When I went there, it completely inspired me to create Skin Iceland. You know, I think places that are spiritual and have a wellness aspect to them are places that really speak to me.
And how about, speaking of Iceland, one thing about Iceland that people might not know, what's some random fact, since I feel like most people are not Icelandophiles?
Well, one thing I find really interesting is that most people sit in the thermal baths naked, and there's a thermal bath like in every community and neighborhood. So people just kind of hang out naked together in Iceland, and I think that's pretty cool.
So basically in Iceland, when you're trying to buy a house, you try to make sure that the neighbors are not that unattractive.
Exactly. Yes, pretty much.
Okay, makes sense. And then what's one thing about the beauty industry that you find stressful?
Probably just that it's so competitive and crowded. So, you know, there's either, you know, always somebody that's like nipping at your heels, trying to take your share of market. And there are also people leaving the market. And, you know, as an entrepreneur, you never like to see that either.
And if there's one person in the world, they can be the most accomplished person in the whole entire world that you can chain to a desk and make your permanent intern at Skin Iceland, you know, who would it be? Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
That's a good
one.
I am going through a little bit of a like RVG like obsession at the moment. So that would be a really good one.
Plus, you don't have to use that strong chains. I feel like you can just use like the cheap stuff and she'd be stuck there.
Exactly.
Okay, so I fed you that one, but fair enough. So now one of the reasons why I'm really glad that we get to talk to you is, like I kind of alluded to, you've been in the industry for a bit and you've seen it through a number of different lenses, right? And I like the fact that there are all these different emerging trends in beauty that you've had to naturally stay on top of in order to be successful and stick around, you know? So One of the things first I wanted to talk about is the consolidation within this industry, right? Because there are a lot of independent brands, but there used to be, I feel like, a lot more. And, you know, it seems like my words, not yours, but there's a lot of consolidation where a big corporation says the easiest way to do our development is just to have a smaller company, you know, test the waters, be successful, and then we're going to go swallow them up. So, what are your thoughts about the general trajectory of the industry at large? What's the state of the industry?
Well, I will say, actually, on the flip side of that, that I never, ever dreamed when I started Skin Iceland that indie brands would have such a prominent place in the industry. You know, we were always like the afterthought, and it was always about the big heritage brands that sort of ruled and created created the rules. And now the whole model has been flipped on its head. So now all the big heritage brands are looking to the indie brands for innovation and trends and trying to copy them. So that is something really still shocking to me. But, you know, I think there is a lot of conversation in the industry about like how long can this last for, this, you know, swallowing up of the small brands and these big valuations and, you know, big brands consistently buying innovation and not creating from within. So I don't know that I have the answer to that, but there doesn't seem to be any slowing down in sight. And I just think it's because, you know, by virtue of the fact that the industry is so competitive and so saturated and so filled, that the brands that are going to succeed are the ones that can move really quickly and be super innovative. And unfortunately, a lot of the big companies can't move that fast.
Yeah, and I think for that reason, I mean, I think you're right that for beauty, but also for a lot of other industries, it seems like it's just cheaper to let your smaller competitors grow and then nip them in the bud before they get, you know, that much bigger. I mean, that if you think about it, like WhatsApp, you know, WhatsApp was acquired for, I believe, like $18 billion by Facebook, which is a little insane. But what that shows you is that there are always going to be larger players that can say, well, you know what, I think that you're going to be worth $100 billion one day, so let me go try to get you for like a cheap little $18 billion, right?
Yeah.
So there was one study that I actually did, so a little shameless plug, but I worked on it with my old agency Proponent, formerly Firebrand Group, and I think I shared this with you, but for those of you who don't know, this was a study of 50 different beauty executives, and we consolidated all of their thoughts about like what are going to be the top trends within beauty over the next few years. I want to run a few of these by you, if that's okay, and just kind of get your thoughts about where they're going. So first off, the delineation of clean beauty versus natural beauty, because I think that there's not that much regulation necessarily in this area. So a lot of brands are making claims that can't be substantiated, and they're saying they're one thing when they're not one thing. So where do you think this is going? Do you think that there'll be more regulation and definition about what each of these terms means? Is this going to be something that consumers are going to consistently ask for from brands, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the term natural beauty is a little bit outdated, actually, and brands have really gravitated much more to this clean vernacular. And I do think that consumers and brands are both asking for some clarification of what clean means, because everybody has a different definition of what that is, including all of the retailers that consider themselves natural or clean retailers. Each one of them has a different list of ingredients they don't want in the product. So it's very confusing for the customer, very confusing for the brands. And I think at some point it's going to have to be modified to be like a united front.
Yeah, because I think that it is this interesting thing where for the longest time, people kind of like within our cohort, what they really cared about was, I just want to get the cheapest possible product. I don't care what you put in it. Does it work more or less fine? And as long as it, works, then like I'll accept whatever trade-offs I have to make. Like, microbeads and PEGs and paraben, like all of that stuff was fine-ish for a while. And then probably right around when you started Skin Iceland, people started getting more educated. They said, like, actually, we're going to be willing to pay a little bit more as long as we understand what we're buying and we can feel a little bit better about what we're, purchasing and having a little bit more of a kinship with nature. So it's interesting to think about, like, is this a cyclical thing? Like, will people constantly care more and more about the quality of the ingredients, or is this a short-term blip and people are going to start to care more about price at some point?
I do not think this is a trend. I think this is something that is here to stay and is going to get more intense. And, I think we were really, really early in this philosophy, because it was just something always really, really important to me personally, because I had a lot of health issues. And so it was something that I really, really was sort of deeply, passionate about. And so I think that with digital media and social media, customers have just become so much more sophisticated and well-educated on certain subjects, especially this. And so I think it's just making the consumer more demanding and more sophisticated, and they're making more demands on the brands that they choose to buy.
In some ways, I kind of think of it as analogous to the medical space, where there's so much information out there. Not all of it's perfect, but I think the very fact that there's a lot of information out there means that you're going to be more demanding of your doctor and be like, I read that I might have this fibro. I literally went to the doctor and thought that I had something that I didn't, but at least I had some decent data to go off of, you know? And so there is more visibility and transparency in the process. And I think it's kind of like that with beauty, right?
Yeah. I think the consumer wants to know that the brands or the companies are accountable, take responsibility for their products, that they care about the consumer. And I think that's, one thing about indie beauty brands that has been really attractive to consumers. Like, it's generally like a small company started by an individual that sees, has a need for themselves and then offers that to other people who also find that void in the marketplace. And, I think with a big company, there's a sense that like nobody cares. It's just a big company. They're just trying to make money. And so I think that's, you know, in this age of like individualization and customization, like that's more and more important.
Oh, yeah, which we're going to talk about actually in a second. Because so sustainability is something that I know is really tied to the natural versus clean beauty phenomenon. And it's not exactly the same thing, but they're often kind of lumped together, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, for people who don't know, how do you really delineate, how do you define sustainability within like a beauty context?
I mean, even though this isn't completely true, I really define it like the clean and the natural is about the formula and the sustainability is about the packaging. It's not always the case because obviously you want to also source sustainable ingredients and not harvest naturals from an environment that's going to compromise the environment. So, I mean, I think there's a real sustainability story there, but I think just sort of like topically, people look at it as, you know, you don't want packaging that's, you know, not recyclable or not biodegradable or, you know, really going to create a big footprint in the environment and the formula really being something that's healthy to put in your body or on your body.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. It's interesting because these things do tend to matter, I would say, to a similar cohort of consumers. But it's not something necessarily, I would say, that is... Some people care more about one thing than the other. You know, some people care about what they're putting on themselves, and some people care about the footprint that anything that they consume is, you know, how what kind of impact that's going to have on the world.
I think the sustainability factor for brands is going to get increasingly more important. I think the sort of clean natural has been sort of the priority, and now sustainability is becoming much, much more important, and I think we're going to see a lot more consumer demand where that goes as well.
I think another thing is especially thinking about changing demographics, you know, like inclusivity. Is inclusivity, because that was something that, you know, the report I worked on kind of defined as a major thing that people are concerned about. My thought about that is that maybe just as a cynical longtime marketer is that brands just say, well, you know, it puts us on the kind of the quote unquote right side of history because our consumer groups are changing and we need to reflect that, but we also need to reflect what they're going to look like 5 years from now so that we can get, you know, we can build some type of relationship with that audience and not just the audience that we have right now. So where do you kind of, I mean, do you think this is something brands are just doing out of the goodness of their hearts or not?
Well,
so
I think I've been thinking about it a lot the last couple of days, actually, because there's a company that just got something like $20 million in funding that is going to be developing multicultural brands within the beauty space. So it's, you know, an ever increasing topic within the beauty space. And I think, you know, it's interesting for me, like when I started in the industry and I worked at L'Oreal, I remember reading a research study that they had done because they had had some, you know, they used to call them ethnic brands.
Like Mazzani and all those,
And they did not have a lot of success with those brands. And the research showed that that customer didn't want to be separated out and treated differently than the mainstream. And I think that was the consumer philosophy back in that day because it wasn't cool to stand out. It was cool to be like everybody else. And now I think because of the cultural movement of like Me Too and, you know, inclusiveness and gender equality and all these things, it's really, I think, made people feel proud to be an individual and who they are. And so I think having brands that speak to that really resonates. And so I think it's a completely different mindset now in the industry. And so I think beauty is starting to reflect as more of those consumers become entrepreneurs and start their own brands. I think it's a more relevant subject. And then, you know, obviously the success of brands like Rihanna, which was, you know, created by like not only a superstar, but, you know, a woman of color, but also is a range that has shades for every skin tone. So I think it's that, like, again, it's kind of flipping the concept on its head. Like, you know, as a Caucasian woman, like, I would certainly consider buying products from that line, even though I have like the whitest skin known to mankind. I don't feel like I'm excluded from that brand, but I don't know that it was a brand that was like created specifically for me, but I feel included in it. And, you know, and I think that's like really what it's all about.
I'm surprised that there aren't any brands that are kind of like trying to cater specifically to white supremacists, you know, just to go in the total opposite direction. Because it really, I mean, it does make me happy that brands are trying to outclass one another from a progressiveness standpoint. I don't mean politically. I just mean looking to see where the demographics are going. Like, yeah. Try to go in the direction of where your customer's going.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm glad that somebody's not trying to profit off of something negative and hurtful. So, I know you didn't mean that, but, you know, I mean, I do think, you know, like it is a little bit of like, where does this all end, and like, to what extent do we go to? I mean, you know, I'm conscious about the models that we use and that we portray, because we don't want to leave anybody out and we don't want to make anybody feel bad. But then we also, you know, as a brand owner, I don't want to be criticized for using certain models just because we didn't think to use another model, or, you know, do something that, you know, yeah, we didn't intend to hurt anybody, but then get criticized for it.
Right. And we do live in, and this could be a whole different rabbit hole we don't have to go down, but we are very much living in the world of let's criticize the heck out of brand X because of a thing that they totally didn't mean to do. Mm-hmm. I would say like 9 out of every 10 brand snafus now are totally unintentional, and yep, people just get excited about piling on. So yeah, you're right. It's you don't want to be that brand who puts yourself in the wrong position for no reason. So. Yeah. And, you know, it's something we were talking about before we started rolling, which I thought was really interesting, is the one group that it seems like there's going to be more of in the next, you know, few years that no brand is really kind of really focusing on is old people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That's what they like to be called, old people. But,
but
seriously, like the demographics of our country, like even though the country as a whole is browning, let's say, the country is also getting older and not necessarily having the same reproductive rate that we had before. We had an infertility expert on the show recently, actually, and this is something we talked about. And I think it's kind of interesting, and I'm wondering why you think maybe, you know, brands are not necessarily, I mean, maybe it's not that cool to, you know, do the new Betty White collection with a foundation or something. But like, why is it that age is the final thing that we don't try to include?
I do think it's interesting that we have sort of been through this timeline of dealing with color, gender, and we have not dealt with age. And I wonder why that is. And somebody who is aging,
oh my God, I'm aging too.
Yeah.
Adam Auer, audio engineer. Yeah. I think he's aging. I saw him yesterday on the subway, and he looked, or at least he was a little younger. So, yeah.
See, I don't even have the right words to describe what it is that I'm trying to say. But, you know, like I was saying before we started, you know, when I started out in marketing at 20, whatever, you know, our segments used to be 25 to 35, 35 to 45, and then 55 plus. And then after 55, you were like, didn't exist. And as I am about 2 months away from venturing into that white space, I find it like I feel young and extremely current. And it seems, you know, very exclusive that nobody is talking to that. And so, you know, I am extremely interested in that subject. And I think that, you know, another trend that we haven't really touched on is, you know, all of the tools in the beauty industry now to really change the way we look as we age. And so we're not aging in the same way. And if you look even at, you know, like a news journalist that was on TV who was in their 50s or 60s, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, they look very different than somebody of that age today. And so I think, you know, aging is, we sort of haven't changed our mindset and our viewpoint on that. But yet, you know, women in their 60s now look like Christie Brinkley. And, you know, women in their late 50s look like Julianne Moore and Michelle Pfeiffer. And so, you know, I think we, like, our mindset needs to catch up with what is actually happening in the world. And it is definitely an untapped portion of the beauty market that some people have started touching on, but I don't think we have really seen that happen yet.
Yeah, well, and I think that that's something that's safe to say. Anybody listening to this can clearly see that there's money to be made in the 55 to 95 group. I mean, there are people who are going to be around for a while after 55, and we'll care how they look.
By 2030, 20% of the population is going to be over 65.
See, and there's like not a single brand that speaks to them right now, which is just unfortunate, you know? So, I mean, another thing that we're kind of talking about, you know, we're talking around is the idea of personalization. And that was one thing that in the study that I ran came up a lot because, you know, beauty has generally been, like with a lot of brands, you know, a mass, produced, set of SKUs where you purchase something that's close-ish to perfect for you, but we can't make perfect for you because we've got to make something that we can sell to all these other people. And it seems like that's something that's kind of changing. And a lot of brands are playing around with personalization. And I'm wondering what you think about that, about the opportunities that that unlocks when somebody can get something that has one particular, let's say, ingredient, amped up or decreased or whatever based off of, you know, their pigmentation or based off of their skin need.
Well, you know, I know when I launched Skin Iceland, there was a brand at Bergdorf's that was a customizable brand of skincare where you would go to the counter, they would swab the inside of your cheek and then send that to a lab. I think it was called Lab 21. And they would create a skincare line for you and then send it back to you. But it took like 2 weeks. And, you know, we're like in this instant gratification society. So like nobody really wanted to wait for that turnaround. And so I sort of predicted that that was not going to work out, and it didn't. But now that technology is getting better and faster, I just saw a brand come out that does the exact same thing, but they can turn it around, I think, in 24, 48 hours. So I think that is very interesting, and I do think that is going to be something that is coming down the pike.
Yeah, and I think that one thing from all the evidence that I've seen on that front is that we can do a lot of those things, but can we do them in a cost-efficient way so that you can actually build a big audience for it? If you can do it, but it's going to cost like the cost of La Mer, which is, for those of you who don't know, insanely high, then you're just not going to have enough people to make it worth it. But if you can drive down the cost, then all of a sudden we could be selling products very differently, not just in beauty, but in like all sorts of I mean, I think a little bit about the personalization that you have with these Coke machines where you can kind of mix your own drink, and I mix the weirdest possible things together. I mean, and if you can do that for other, you know, products and you can kind of personalize it, even if it works more or less the same, but you've changed it a little bit to make it yours, I think people feel very kind of close to their own version.
Yeah, I mean, like we even have products that, you know, you just mix together like a powder and a gel, and just that makes you feel like you're kind of customizing it, even though you're not really changing anything about the formula person to person. But I think just that act of mixing it together, making it feel fresh or like you've done something to change it, is relevant.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that, let me see, I think that there's and not too many other topics within that particular report. I think CBD was one that I think was really, interesting. And especially, I know that you have, you know, like eye gels that people really talk about. Have you thought about a CBD eye gel or not necessarily, you know, in the 2020 plans?
Well, we've definitely thought about CBD. I mean, I think it goes really well with our whole stress relief concept. I don't know yet in what form we're going to deliver it in, but I think we're still like on the frontier of this whole category, and you know, there's still a lot we need to see in terms of what's going to happen with regulation and the FDA. So determining how much of the active is in the product or not in the product. So, I mean, I think there's still a lot of question marks about this new category.
And one thing that's interesting to me about CBD is that that's a thing that, you know, like so many different products have tried to, like, oh, hey, we're going to put some CBD in your iPhone case. Why not? And, you know, everybody's really kind of jumped in and thrown it into, you know, but I feel like that's a thing that beauty has always had, where there's always been kind of like one hero ingredient, like turmeric, yep. where all of a sudden everybody yep. loves it, or yep. argan you
right.
know, oil.
I think there's so many trends that start where like a brand goes all out in this one concept. And then the way the trend sort of can, you know, sustains itself is that it becomes like a product or a vertical within an existing brand. So like now there are all these CBD brands, but ultimately like every brand will probably have like a CBD product within their portfolio or assortment.
Yeah. And it's true. It's also one of those things that it kind of gets me thinking about the fact that even though, you know, we talk about things that are very forward looking on the show, one thing that kind of cracks me up a little bit is that beauty is often about finding this thing that maybe, you know, mankind has known about for thousands of years, but then spinning it in a different way in a product. And yeah. and then we call that innovation, but it's like yeah. really actually somebody in China was, you know, throwing it in their hair, you know, 8,000 years ago
right.
or whatever.
Right. Like, I mean, milk is the perfect example of that. I mean, Cleopatra used to put like milk on her face to do masks. And now we do, you know, lactic acid from milk is, you know, one of the hottest ingredients. So it is completely true.
Are there any particular ingredients that you're like from a competitive standpoint paying attention to right now?
I mean, you know, I think, you know, peptides continue to be hot. Hyaluronic acid is really hot ingredient. Anything stem cell oriented is really hot, especially stem cells from plants. Those are ingredients that we've looked at for years and we've been using in our products for years. What's the other? I mean, minerals.
Well, that's about vitamins, a bunch,
you know,
right,
I mean,
there. Yeah.
yeah.
And also one thing kind of circles back to something you were talking about before, which is there's a little bit more of a convergence between wellness and things that you ingest, mm-hmm. you know, in the name of being healthy and having healthy skin.
Yeah.
You know, like ingestibles and collagen powders, like to put into a smoothie that are then going to improve certain things about your appearance, you know, like that's like, it's all interconnected. And I yeah. feel like you are going to see more brands that are doing things that are all about kind of overall, you know, skin and, you know, wellness. So.
Well, I was going to say, you know, one of the ingredients that we used really early on, our group of ingredients, is adaptogens. And it's something that started as something you take internally that helps fortify your body against the breakdown of stress. And we used it in a skincare product for the same reason. And now it's sort of having resurgent. It was really hot in the 70s. Like a lot of hippies were into adaptogens. And now, you know, it's sort of having a resurgence. So I think that's like a perfect example of that. And I launched the brand with an ingestible. But, you know, 15 years ago, people were not at all, like, kind of couldn't wrap their head around it. Like, editors thought it was really cool and wrote about it, but the consumer was afraid to buy it. Whereas now I think it's a much more acceptable thing. And like you said, like, lots of brands have powder or liquid collagen, and people are drinking that in smoothies. And so it's become much more mainstream. And I think we're definitely going to see more of that.
But it does bring up an important point, which I think about a lot, is you have to get the timing right with all these things. I mean,
yeah.
if you introduce anything, you know, whether or not you have a tangible product or like a SaaS, you know, digital service, and it's the best idea in the world, but it's 8 years ahead of its time, then it doesn't, I mean, when's the last time you logged on to Friendster, you know, or MySpace, right?
Right.
So that's a perfect example. I keep wondering what Tom and his white t-shirt are doing right now. So, but you know, it's like you have to have the right idea at the right time and execute it properly.
Yeah.
And if all those things don't align, you might actually have something that could have worked, but,
yeah.
you know, just
yeah.
it doesn't.
Well,
so
I mean, I've been asked a lot in the last couple of weeks about, you know, what it was about Drunk Elephant that got them an $845 million valuation. And I think it's exactly what you're saying. It was a lot about timing.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Not to
yeah.
take anything away from them, but like they had a good idea at the right time and executed great. And so that's, it just speaks to that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'll put something in the show notes about that actually, because I was just reading a good article about that earlier today. So yeah, I feel like we talked about a lot. I think that, you know, maybe in closing, maybe I should ask you, what's one thing that you're working on internally at Skin Iceland? Like, we talked a lot about the industry and you educated everybody at large, but what's one thing you're really proud of that you're working on, you know, for the brand right now?
Well, there's two things, really. I mean, we're launching a new product in January that I'm really excited about, and I feel like I can finally start talking about it because it's right around the corner. But, you know, our eye gels are sort of the gold standard in the mass category, and we have, like, a huge celebrity following for that product, and makeup artists love it. And so we've, you know, I've been thinking for a long time, like, what's the next eye gel? And in January, we're launching a dissolving microneedle eye patch, and I think it's going to be quite extraordinary. I mean, it's something you wear overnight, and it has incredible treatment benefits and results. And I think it is really transformative in a way that skincare is now able to do. You don't have to go to the dermatologist or the plastic surgeon, and you don't have to go to MediSpa. You can actually deliver that, you know, at a retail in a retail environment. So I'm really excited about that. And you know, I obviously am a huge believer in the naturals that grow in Iceland. And so we've been very active in finding new natural ingredients with powerful benefits that are from Iceland. And we sourced an incredible microalgae there a couple of years ago that we launched in a serum last year. It's a red serum that has an antioxidant in it called astaxanthin, which is 6,000 times more effective than vitamin C. And it is doing incredibly well because the results are speak for themselves. And we are not only going to do a lot more with that ingredient, but we're also looking at other things that we can develop that are unique from Iceland.
That's really cool. And if those of you guys who have eyes or, you know, general eye area, and haven't heard of these eye gels, definitely look up to see some of the celebrity reviews. It almost seems like Sarah has dirt on like a hidden sex tape for every single one of these celebrities, because that's how great the reviews are for these things. Yeah, it's really impressive. And obviously the continued success is great, especially in a world that's dominated by a few really big companies. So, yes, thank you so much, Sarah, for making the time. This was a great conversation.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun.
And thanks again, Sarah, for joining us. I told you you would learn a lot about this nerdy world of beauty that I personally have spent a lot of time in. And a lot of people have asked for more information about what direction it's going. So hopefully this satiated some of your curiosity. We'll have a few other beauty-related shows coming up in the near term, so stay tuned. Once again, you can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever finer podcasts are sold. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.